You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Okay, here we are. Hello, Amy Wax. How are you?
Good.
Good. This is Glenn Lowry, The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, brought to you from the Watson Institute on International Public Affairs at Brown. And Amy Wax is the Robert Mundheim Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a frequent guest on The Glenn Show, author of books and articles of some significance on the law and social issues. And Amy, when I Googled you to find out the name of your chair, three out of four entries on the page said controversial law professor Amy Wax. I wonder why.
That's my label.
Okay, well, I think viewers of The Glenn Show who have not heard Amy before will be happy to be hearing from her, and will probably understand better at the end of this conversation why why she is regarded as controversial.
You're raising expectations here, Glenn.
Well, no. I mean, we were just talking before we started recording about what we would talk about, and there are a number of things on our agenda, but we seem to be settling in on this question of the state of intellectual integrity and the capacity for free thought and expression in the universities because of political pressures on people to conform to a liberal line, and also about the extent to which that impedes our understanding of and our ability to formulate policies about and to even discuss various kinds of inequalities and differences and outcomes and achievement that we see in society between population groups. I mean, I was struck, for example, and I won't talk too long. I want us to let you set the framework for what you see as the general climate problem in academia. And then we can get into some of the details on these inequality things. But I just wanted, if you'll allow me to mention this one thing, reading the newspaper the other day and then following my Twitter feed, the results for the admissions process at the Stuyvesant High School in New York City, the exam school elite, very difficult to get into. You have to take a specialized exam and score way, way in the right tail. And I don't know how many thousands take it, but they admit 895 in a class this year, and only seven of them are African American. And the headlines in the newspaper were like, scandal, segregated. Segregation has returned to the American high school because they don't have more than 1%. Don't even have 1% of the class being African American. And it was just ipso facto, if the number of African Americans were low, then it must be racially unfair.
Of course.
And the thing that I thought was, my God, they're advertising the low achievement of African Americans on this exam. They're advertising it and then crossing their arms across their chest and tapping their toe and looking at you as if to say, see there, I told you, see there, I told you. And I just left scratching my head. I mean, it really befuddled me because I don't think people know how they must seem to, I don't know what percentage of Americans who would, you know, hear that headline, but to a lot of them, I can't be the only one. They're going to be saying, well, the blacks aren't doing very well, are they? I mean, why is that the fault of the school? It's a fair exam. The Asians are scoring off the charts on the exam. What's wrong with people? So, I mean, that's just one example, I think, of the thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I think this is very pertinent to your wonderful Manhattan Institute talk about the state of black leadership and opinion among, you know, the cognitive elite about what's going on with race and inequality in America. This is an example of a big bluff, right? To look at these results knowing that this is an exam application process. It's sort of very blatant that there's one way in. It's hard to hide it. And by definition, blacks aren't getting in because they're doing poorly on the exam. Yet you can read the progressive narrative in the New York Times, which you can always rely upon them to provide the orthodox opinion, and barely even hear about this fact. I mean, this fact, if you read the story on the front page of the New York Times today, it never says, well, the reason blacks aren't getting into these elite schools is that they're not doing that well on the test. No, they just zoom right past that and say, this is racism, it's the legacy of racism, it's discrimination, this is the standard narrative, it's all papered over with euphemism. If they are forced to say in passing that they're doing poorly on the test, they immediately revert to this kind of structural racism, legacy of racism, this narrative, this way of thinking about it. So they never deviate from the script. And what's interesting to me is not so much the script, which is standard and, of course, comes out of academia. It dominates business now, the nonprofits, the philanthropies. It's become this hideous hydra-headed monster. But the refusal of people to challenge it, right? So where is this narrative being challenged head on? Hey, wait a second. Let's think about what's really going on here. What's really going on here is decades of underachievement. Can we talk about what's causing that and what to do about it? Can we get into some behavioral issues that might not be too comfortable? No, that's not happening on the pages of the New York Times, I'll tell you that. And it's not happening in the university either. I'll tell you the only place it's happening. Maybe a little bit in think tanks, conservative think tanks, and on the web. Intellectual life has moved to the web and mainly to the so-called dark web. And of course, if you look at media outlets like the New York Times, the standard left media, we call it Pravda in our household, right? Their take on the dark web is it's a bunch of knuckle-dragging Nazis. You know, don't read that stuff. It's harmful. It's traumatizing. It's evil. I mean, they really have a lock on the whole intellectual space. And I wonder two things. How did that happen? And what can we do about it?
Okay, let me say a couple of things. The narrative, you say, like a hydra-headed monster, it spread from the universities into the interstices of our economic and political lives. And let me see if I get right how one might characterize this narrative, which is that in the case of racial inequality, the differences are due to structural factors and not to the inabilities or lack of performance of blacks. We're talking about blacks. And that this narrative is explaining everything from the low representation of blacks in the exam school in New York to how many partners are there at big white shoe law firms to how many physicians are there running major operations at hospitals and so on and so on. This hydra-headed monster, and you're saying, secondly, that it can't be discussed honestly anywhere, not certainly in the universities and not in the, as it were, mainstream media, but you're taking some comfort in the existence of places where people, thoughtful people, can communicate about these issues without having to go past the censors at these major portals, and that you're calling the dark web. So I'm not going to counter, because I don't think I disagree much with what you're saying. I make a couple observations. One of them is that I think one reason why the narrative has so many heads is that the people are not able to deal with the consequences of acknowledging certain realities. They are ashamed. They are afraid. They're really weak. They may have the political upper hand in certain prominent venues of communication and cultural influence. But at the root, they're weak, and they know that they're weak, and they're afraid, and they're ashamed. And they're ashamed of what it is that might be said about them, how people might judge them and think of them in their failure. And so they rally to this counter narrative, you know, about no, it's the test. I mean, think about it for a minute. You have this highly competitive process. You got 1,000 kids roughly who are coming close to being able to get in, and you got a handful of black kids in a city of millions of people. A handful. Gosh, you're right. What does it say? It says, I wouldn't say, myself personally, Glenn Lowry, that it says that they're genetically inferior. I think we'd have a very long way to go empirically to get to that conclusion. But it definitely says that their performance is abysmal in terms of competitive things. Their mastery over the material. And to blame it on the test, which is only a messenger here. I mean, God, can't anybody see that? And not to see the slippery slope into relativism, and really the threat to a kind of foundation of civilization. I'm not exaggerating. That is implied by the surrender of standards. I won't make any judgments because the consequence of judging will be to expose the inadequacy of my dear fellows over here who are vulnerable and about whom I care, who are the victims of a history of whatever. And therefore, I won't make judgments. I'll erase lines. I'll broaden and coarsen information that's available about differences in human performance so as not to have to face up to this reality. So they are ashamed. Now, just the other thing I'll say, one reason why the discourse is impaired in certain places is because people don't trust the motives of those engaged in the discourse who are prepared to call a spade a spade. They think that they are racist. Now, partly that's a cover, right? Oh, I'm going to call you a racist as a way of getting you to shut up. But partly it's really true. They really do think that they are racist. They think blacks are inferior. They think that the people who are prepared to point out the low performance of blacks think that blacks don't have what it takes. And if they do think that, the political implications of critics of blacks thinking that blacks don't have what it takes are bracing. I'm not going to worry about whether or not there are any blacks appointed to the bench. I'm not going to worry about whether or not blacks are represented in the leadership suites of this particular or that particular endeavor. Of course, blacks are overrepresented in the jails. After all, didn't you read the memo? Blacks don't have what it takes. So people are afraid of that kind of politics. And I would say not without reason to be afraid of that kind of politics. Shame and fear. That's my explanation of the problem.
Well, yes, shame and fear, and I think wishful thinking as well. I think, you know, very well-meaning people really do believe in equality. They want to bring about equality. They can't tolerate psychically or otherwise this inequality, and they'll do anything necessary to bring it about. But, you know, when you say shame and fear, I really, in the current climate, don't think that goes far enough. I think that Prague aggressiveness, I will call it progressive aggressiveness, just for short, has acquired this kind of vengeful, aggressive, punitive aspect to it. At the end of the day, I think it is a gloves off, no holds barred grab for power. I think progressives have, they're very smart people, and they have figured out how to bring dissenters and reality noticers to heel. And here's how they've done it. They have moralized politics in the progressive mode. And actually, there's a very smart interview that Harvey Mansfield gives online in a place called In Point magazine, where he says, here's what progressives have done. They have taken a number of beliefs and areas that used to be controversial and sort of the perpetual realm of differences of viewpoint and differences in opinion, and they have taken them out of politics and said that's what being progressive means. We are moving ever upward to a higher place, a better place, a more moral place where we can all come to an agreement that there is a certain way society should be run. It is, of course, the equality-obsessed progressive way that society is run. And anybody who dissents from that view, who doesn't agree, is not only wrong, but they are evil. Right? So that move from wrong to evil.
Excuse me, but I just want a clarification. By taking out of politics, he means the issue is no longer subject to legitimate disputation.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
No longer subject to legitimate disputation. We know the right and the wrong. It's a little bit like science, right? And, of course, the irony is that even science is subject to a great deal of disputation. But I think we can all agree that the earth is round and that sort of thing.
No, so, but let me just interject again. You're making, and I'll be brief, a very important point about the climate debate, where people play this science card, okay? Right. And what they're really saying is the science has resolved what are far from being resolved questions about how to respond to whatever the objective exigencies are. those right. questions, how much to spend today, tomorrow, when to give, where and how and who, those are legitimately disputatious or subject to disputation. Notwithstanding the fact that scientists may agree that the earth is warming and that human activity contributes to it. So there's a move, a power move, as you say, that's made when they try to take an issue, you know, socialism or capitalism as the response to climate.
Right. And I realize I'm taking a great risk by saying this, and I've had people almost walk out of, you know, social events when I say this, but, you know, I would like to study the data on climate change. I just cannot believe that an area where, you know, we have to make so many choices for models and so many assumptions is open and shut. I mean, the discourse surrounding climate change makes me laugh. You know,
I start with the Glenn Show episode where I interviewed Patrick Brown, who's a postdoctoral fellow out at Stanford in the climate science area, who's an expert. And we spent an hour and 10 minutes, you know, I just wanted to know answers to simple questions. And he, you know, and there's a lot of room for debate about various, and especially various aspects of what's going on, and especially with respect to how to respond to it, what the sort of economic trade-offs are across generations, and, you know, how to deal with the global commons problem, because they're independent decision makers, and, you know, we've got a lot of different countries here, and they're not all on the same page. And to a certain degree, there's a game of give and take that's going on, but, you know. So anyway, there's a lot.
So what I'm really saying is, you know, there are more and more areas, including one really hot button one that we talked about before this began, of, you know, cognitive differences between groups, between genders, where if you even say, well, I actually think the data is inconclusive, as I did at one conference, here's the response. You are a vile person. That is the word that was used about me. So, you know, there are more and more areas where the truth has been established. Now, once you move from hard science to the social sciences to the human sciences, well, it gets squishier and squishier, yeah, but sure. The certainty of the Prague establishment doesn't get any softer. They get even more ferocious because they want to establish that there is one right point of view.
Okay, so, now let me just put this to you, which this scientist I interviewed, Patrick Brown, maybe 6-8 months ago, raised, which was the one thing that you want to do if you want to get ahead in science is be the first person to publish something that nobody else and to publish it with rigor and with support that nobody else has seen. Okay, that's how you get a Nobel Prize. That's how you get famous. That's how you get a gazillion citations. You get there first. And that's just a really, really, really powerful incentive. And I don't have that with respect to a lot of issues that come up in political debate, which will engender herd behavior and politically correct moral virtue signaling. A lot of issues have the property that there's no bottom line, there's no, you know, objective resolution. And so a person doesn't, you know, defy the crowd and then get credit at the end of the day because the you know, the data came in on his or her side. And he says, therefore, even though there is political correctness in the science, he acknowledged that, you know, journal editors who want the answer to be a particular thing, researchers who might bias their data, how they look at their data in favor of finding a particular view. He didn't believe at the end of the day that if there were a refutation clear and simple to some of the claims that it wouldn't see light, because he thought somebody is going to want to be, you know, the Nobel laureate in the year 2030 for having discovered something really important about this question. Yeah. And I find that to be a pretty compelling observation.
Well, Glenn, I think in hard science, you may be right, but I can tell you, for example, that in medical science, all right, they have had an infusion a veritable invasion of politically correct ideas and notions and presuppositions. So if you look at this week's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, okay, the first four articles are about racism, discrimination, and disparities. They're obsessed with disparities. They are obsessed with inequality. And once again, and inequality in the demographics of med school.
That's what I'm asking.
Patient outcomes, different patient populations for various diseases, how they're treated. And you get the sense reading these articles, Glenn, that there is one and only one answer. I mean, the article about, the paucity of blacks in med school and actually declining numbers, I don't think that article even mentions the MCAT or MCAT scores. I mean, the reportage is so utterly tendentious. And this is characteristic of social science. So I encountered a study just today in the race area, and gender is completely contaminated by this, that I think really points up how tendentious, how easy it is to be one-sided, unbalanced, and tendentious in social science. So I was watching a YouTube video of Steve Hayward, who's a conservative pundit who actually teaches out at Berkeley, and he talked about a study that was done in California about webcams of police encounters with motorists. They studied thousands of webcams, and the researchers, some from Stanford and some other places.
This is Jennifer Eberstadt, I think, the social psychologist at Stanford. Yeah.
They reported. The way that it, well, let's start with how the media reported it. All right. The media reported this study as researchers find that that police are much less polite to black motorists than to others, right? That was the conclusion. Now, as Hayward said, if you actually read the actual study, here's what you find. The police were as polite to elderly blacks and female blacks. The only blacks that they were rude to, and they had a way of scoring rudeness, of course, were young black men. Now, here's something the study didn't do, right? They didn't look at how the motorists spoke to the police. That was just completely left out. Now, there is one line in the discussion of the study, and Hayward said, I don't know how they got away with this, where the researchers say in a moment of uncharacteristic candor, well, it is possible that the young black men were not terribly nice to the police or were confrontational or uncooperative. I don't even think they got into that much detail. But, of course, we'll never know, Glenn, because the way they designed the study, they didn't look at both sides of the interaction. Now, that is a choice in study design, which is, I think, highly tendentious and is directed at getting the result that you want to get. Then, of course, the press spins it even more skewed by failing to point out that this obnoxious behavior, as they characterized it, only applied to certain subgroups of minorities.
Okay, so
this kind of thing goes on all the time.
I got it. And so what are we to do? I mean, I'm listening to you. My head is nodding because I agree with you. And it's bad. It's very bad. I don't know if I should say this. Paul Krugman gives me the creep sometimes. Paul Krugman, this is the Nobel laureate economist writing on the op-ed page of the New York Times.
I have a solution to that, Glenn. I don't read him.
Yeah, why read him? Okay, I know. He too is tendentious in his way, and you know, there's kind of everything, the data always come out to be, you know, favoring the, and he's snooty and dismissive of people and whatnot. And I feel like he was a very great economist in his day in terms of the impact that he had on the discipline from some very creative ideas he had about international trade theory and the theory of economic development, economic geography. So, I mean, he's written some seminal articles and, you know, he's got a Nobel Prize, more power to him. On the other hand, I think, you know, gosh, he's now become this guy who's, using the veneer of my science as a cover and a legitimator for being another one of these pundits. And again, predictably, always predictably left of center.
Right.
So well, I know what you're talking about, but here's what I want to ask you. Hmm. People listening to this are going to say, some are going to say, even those who agree with us, they're going to roll their eyes and they're going to say, these people are always complaining. They're just whining. They're just like lamenting. They're just crying in their beer. Okay. They're losing the culture war, and they can't take it. What are we to do that's beyond lament that would be constructive here?
Well, first of all, of course we're whining. I mean, the question is not, you know, are we whining? Are we complaining? Because I'm Jewish and the lifeblood of you know, my entire family's character is to complain. But rather whether, you know, if you're not complaining, you're not alive. The question is the legitimacy and the basis for the complaint, whether you have a legitimate basis for your complaint. So that's the first question, and I want to return to that. But in terms of what we can do about it, I have been going around the country talking to academic audiences and non-academic audiences and to other countries about my experiences, you know, being targeted and mugged in academia for my dissenting views. And I always get someone who asks me, it's usually a student, right? What can we do? And I'm afraid I don't have a good answer for them, because the dynamic has tipped sharply in favor of, you know, the Prague narrative. They have a grip, an iron grip on the university. They now have extended that, as I said, to business, to the foundations. I mean, the fact that business has gone over to a slavish devotion to this these progressive catechism, to this dogma, is stunning to me. I mean, we have so many easy answers.
It does not surprise me at all, Amy. Why do you think? Let's take an
example. It's not in their economic self-interest.
No, I think it may be. Why would Nike adopt Colin Kaepernick? Why would Nike give him a contract and make him a part of their brand? They've made a calculation. Now, they may prove to be wrong in the end, but they know a whole lot more about their market than I do. They're selling sneakers, Amy.
That's pure marketing, Glenn. What about policies about hiring, employment? Goldman Sachs pledging to have 50% women bankers. You know, as a student of mine said in a seminar, take their money out.
One thing at a time. I mean, come on. Can we talk about one thing
at a time? Does that make any sense?
No.
Let me tell you why it doesn't.
Well, hold on. Give me a chance, Amy. I just want to say one thing, okay? Businesses are driven by their bottom line. I remember Milton Friedman, when people were talking about corporate responsibility way back in the 60s when I was a kid, saying, you know, come on, man, corporations in business to make money. When you talk about responsibility, you're just putting another constraint on the corporation. They are interested in their bottom lines. I get to personnel decisions in a moment. As far as branding and advertising, and as far as being afraid of boycotts and being afraid of having something besmirch their brand in their market, they're putting their finger in the air. They're seeing which way they think the wind is blowing, and they're making a calculation. I'm not surprised at that at all, that in a world where diversity of identity and partisanship along that fault line was important to people's economic behavior, that the businesses catering to such people would also cater to their political opinion. Now, as far as personnel decisions are concerned, I don't know. Let me see how many of these people make partner. It's one thing to hire them through the front door. It's another thing to give them a piece of the action and to have to depend on their doing their jobs well for your own bottom line. I'm prepared to bet that they're not lowering the standards. I don't know about full professor in the economics department where you teach, but the place where I teach, you ain't getting full professor based upon some external pressure about diversity. The university president can shout until her cows come home. She can scream and pound the table. We're not giving tenure to anybody who we don't think raises the bar in our department. I mean, I'm pretty confident about that, and I think a lot of departments are like that.
Well, you know, that's economics. But let's talk about sort of the beginning of the pipeline. I think what's going on here, and to me it's very disturbing, is a kind of collective action problem. Everybody looks over their shoulders. You know, Ford looks at GM. GM looks at Goldman Sachs and says, well, we don't want to be the one to stick our neck out and, you know, put forward some commonsensical observations about why the aspiration of 50-50 top brass by gender just makes no sense on the basis of facts, which of course it doesn't, and I'll tell you in a minute why it doesn't. But if we all said that together and adduced the facts that support that, then we would be on much safer ground. What you don't realize, Glenn, is that even though there is, you know, obviously an impulse to please the people who are engaged in identity grievance politics, which seems to be everybody in our sphere, there are a large number of people out there in the real world, you know, in the heartland, who just hate this stuff. Okay? Trump did get elected. And they are pissing these people off. They are alienating them. When I go around the country to talk, I mean, I get cheers and whoops and applause when I attack this kind of silly, stupid grievance identity politics. I was in Philadelphia two nights ago on a panel on free speech, and we talked about the Ronald Sullivan case at Harvard. So what case is that? Well, there's a dean at Harvard. He's a professor at Harvard Law School as well, a black guy, who's defending Harvey Weinstein and giving him the defense that in our system he deserves. And the female students, in their typical whiny, emotional, reactive way, have complained, well, we don't feel safe with this guy being, you know, one of the deans.
Can I mention guy is black? Can I just mention that? Not that that matters in particular, but somehow it matters to me. He's a black guy.
Well, he did, and he actually at some point pulled the race card, which was rather disappointing. But I thought he acquitted himself very well in defending himself. But here's what I said at the panel. I said, this is a missed opportunity and teachable moment. Instead of Harvard groveling and saying, oh, you poor dears, we're going to have to really consider your emotions and feelings, anybody with backbone, any administrator with backbone, and of course administrators have none, would have said, you don't understand. Your feelings aren't really legitimate. They have no valid basis. And let me teach you why. Number one, everyone in our system deserves a defense. That's really important for you law students to understand. Number two, Mr. Sullivan, by defending Harvey Weinstein, is not condoning what he does. These are elementary lessons that are not...
Well, the irony is, of course, that most of these kids are going to be pro-defense in their general inclination. They're going to be worried about incarceration, and they're going to think felons' rights should be defended to the max, except when it comes to a felon who has committed an offense that they don't like.
A white guy.
Listen, exactly. I was going to say this. I think I know what to do, and I need your help. I think 250 of us, and you know what I mean by when I say of us, who've had it up to here with this wonderful... potentially a magnificent environment that we occupy in the academy, and the privilege that we have of getting paid to do what we do, research and teaching and writing and so on. 250 of us ought to hang out a shingle. We ought to say we are the real university. Come up with a better name than that. And we're going to charge $100,000 a year per kid. Okay? And we're going to admit 1,000 kids. Let's see, that's $100 million. We can probably pay our salaries and have a little bit left over for the maintenance crew. And you know what? People are going to pay it. They're already paying $70,000 with room and board at one of these elite colleges where the kids are not getting an education, and they know it. They know they're not getting an education. They know they're getting brainwashed. They'll pay us $100, $125 grand a year per kid, okay? With 250 of us, we're going to get some wealthy benefactors. And, you know, they're out there, billionaires who want to change the script in higher education.
Can I answer this? Can I address this?
Can we do it? No, I just want to know if we can do it.
I'm happy to do it, but I'm going to tell you why I don't think it's going to work. I actually have another idea, which I'm developing this summer, called Defund the Ivies. But that has a different orientation. But here's why it isn't going to work. And I've talked to several people about this. I may have said something about it on your program as well. I don't know. It's what I call the little Caitlin problem, and I would couple it with the Brian Kaplan problem. All right. So we'll start with Brian Kaplan. Brian Kaplan wrote a book called The Case Against Education, and here is his, it's 500 pages, but here is the thesis in a nutshell. Right. It does not really matter what people learn or don't learn in college. College is this vast, expensive, elaborate HR department for elite jobs and for entry into the upper middle class. And they are really good at selecting the smartest and the most comprehensive, the most conscientious people. He calls them conformists, right? I would rather use the term conscientious. But It picks them at the admission stage, and that's what they're expert at, the smart people. And then it slogs them through 4 years of nonsense, so they come out the other side, and that puts the imprimatur of, you can jump through hoops. And that's what employers want to know. Now, the people who are just falling all over themselves to get their kids into Harvard and Yale, right, they know that. They are paying for that stamp of approval. They are certainly not paying for what goes on during those 4 years. And indeed, here is something that parents have complained about to me. It's really kind of comic. They say, I spent $300,000 sending my daughter to Northwestern, and she came home and told me what a hegemonic, evil, patriarchal, white supremacist, male, racist male I am. You know, that's a little bit upsetting. I said, well, you're paying for it. You know, why are you paying for it? You're not any less eager to have your daughter go to Princeton or Northwestern because she learns this nonsense. And take my word for it, she is learning this nonsense. Okay, so what do we do about that? I call it the little Caitlin problem. When you're talking about parents, trustees, and donors, they want little Caitlin in, they want little Caitlin out. And, you know, Harvard and Yale have inordinate power, or Northwestern.
Let me stipulate that.
Top places.
Let me stipulate that there's much to what you say. I still don't see why that says what I propose couldn't work. I don't say that it will shut down Harvard and Yale. I say that it's a money pump for me and you, and that there will be good done in the world by doing it. There are some people who get a college education not because an employer is going to respond to them, but because they're edified by the college education. And there's some parents and philanthropists, I think, who would take cotton to that idea.
Well, Glenn, I'm worried that there aren't enough of them. You know, a friend of mine on the dissident right quoted to me something from A.E. Housman, the poet, and I've never forgotten it. A.E. Housman said, the love of truth is the faintest of human passions. And I just think that the love of truth is a niche taste, right? And it's interesting because the founders of universities hundreds, nay, thousands of years ago, they knew that. They knew that the academic enterprise, the impulse that desires to examine ideas, examine facts, you know, engage in discourse, rigorous and honest, and get at the truth, that impulse is not one that is shared by the great majority of society. Most people have very little interest in it. They are only interested in, you know, they talk a good game. There's an enormous amount of boring, highfalutin talk about education and enlightenment, and most of it coming from administrators who frankly couldn't care less about that, right? Who are just running these shows because they're very lucrative and sought out because they once again are the gateway to the upper middle class. I worry that if we establish this alternative university, you know, we build it, they won't come.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a bet, I guess. I'm thinking enough will come.
I have an alternative suggestion.
Yeah, well, hold on. I want to tell you a story first before you do. You told me about little Caitlin. I want to tell you about, what's this kid's name? Oh, my.
I can give him a name.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I probably should give him a name. I'm going to call him Josh. Josh is from Greater New York. Josh is a concert pianist. Josh is a freshman. Josh is a classics a major in his first year, and he's very interested in politics and philosophy. So Josh and I have decided that we're going to do an independent study next year. This is why I love my job. We're going to read Plato. Something in the dialogues. We're going to read Milton on free speech. This classic essay. We're going to read Leo Strauss, Persecution and the Art of Writing. We're going to read this wonderful book. Oh gosh. Forbidden Knowledge by Roger Shattuck. You know, he's a French literature expert. He's dead now. But the book is about the history and human culture of not being able to say what's true. You know, Pandora's box, right. The forbidden fruit, not to eat from the tree of knowledge. Oppenheimer pondering the implications of letting the genie out of the bottle on the atom, you know, on weapons and stuff like that. Modern day biology with all of the fraught frontiers that people are exploring in terms of manipulation of the human genome and such. In other words, we created a course. He and I are going to read these books together. We're going to read some of George Orwell's essays. We're going to read Vaclav Havel, trying to tell the truth about totalitarianism in Eastern Europe. Anyway, I'll stop, okay? I just wanted to tell the story about this kid because we are not the same color. We don't belong to the same generation, he and I. We would worship different gods if either one of us were inclined to worship. He's a musician. I'm a mathematician, social scientist. But we both love these books, okay? And we're going to read them together. I'm so excited about that, Amy. And I found this kid at Brown. While all of what you describe is going on, nevertheless, in the midst of it, comes Josh, and he and Professor Lowry develop a relationship. And we grow together because even though I'm much, much older, many times his age, I can learn from him. And I know that I have some things to say that he's going to appreciate. So,
well, Glenn, I'm not denying. No.
Okay. But
you misunderstand me here. Okay. I am not denying that such young people exist. I am not denying. And it's wonderful you tell the story because what it shows is that intellectual interests can be a kind of unifying force that allow people to bridge differences and see their common humanity. And I would for a moment deny that that is the case. And it's a wonderful thing when it happens. And we are throwing up young people who are naturally intellectually honest and rigorous and are curious and are seeking. But here's the thing that I want to say about it. Number one, those people are rare and they are always in the minority. Now, we can socialize people to the love of learning, to the love of truth, to intellectual honesty and rigor. I don't think we're doing that in the current age. I think we're doing the very opposite, actually. But if you have an atmosphere that socializes people, you can sway people who might be less naturally inclined in that direction to do more of it, right? So this is a very familiar idea, just like you can sway women to get more interested in science than they would be in a completely free-for-all environment. But Glenn, there are limits to how many people you can make that way, right? How many people are really truly going to have a passion for learning? And I think that the democratization of higher education, really the longer that I am in this business and the more I go around talking about this subject, the more it impresses me that the democratization of academic higher education has been on some level a mistake. Now, here's what's interesting, because it's been taken over by people who really don't care about this stuff. They have other agendas.
What do you mean by democratization? I just want to be explicit.
I mean, sending more and more people into academic higher education programs as opposed to technical programs, vocational programs. Now, if you go to continental Europe, it's very interesting. Continental Europe is trending in that direction, but they are not nearly where we are.
I know.
You know, in Holland, in France, yeah. In Germany, a very tiny percentage of their students, and you know, their kids are just as smart as ours, if not more so, go into that kind of secondary, tertiary education. They go to sometimes very sophisticated technical programs, professional programs. There's no pretense that, you know, they are there to discover the truth and yeah. to do new research. I mean, I really think that we should think seriously about returning to that kind of a system. Now, that ain't going to happen, all right? It ain't going to happen for a million reasons.
You got all the Democrats. Democratic candidates saying that they want free college.
Right, which is just exactly the opposite of what they should be saying. Yeah. So, I mean, that brings me to my proposal for, you know, what to do about this, I think, baleful situation.
Defund the Ivies? Is that what I heard you say?
Defund the Ivies. So my fantasy is that we would wake up tomorrow morning, you and I, and no one would give another penny to the top 30 schools. And, of course, everybody would scream, what about research? What about medical research? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, I think we could peel off medical research. And anyway, little known fact, 75% of scientific and medical grants go into this general overhead slush fund that, you know, the bureaucracy gets to use for all their little pet programs and services.
Where did that number come from? 75%?
Well,
I never heard of 75%.
The people I know in medical research who complain bitterly about how their grant money is divided up, divvied, and allocated. All right, I mean, I could try to go on the web and get.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've heard of overhead, but it's always been like 20%, not 70%.
Well, for medical grants, it's quite high.
Okay.
For scientific grants, it's quite high. Okay. And this becomes discretionary funding for, because the university says, well, we have to maintain this elaborate infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. But this is peripheral to my point.
Yeah,
my point is Princeton doesn't need another penny. You know, Brown doesn't need another penny. So who needs more attention in our society? Here's what I submit. The average person, the ordinary, unspecial person, the person who never gets near a selective university, right? Whether you like it or not, the universities that take, let's say, less than 30% of their applicants undergrad, first of all, they're a tiny percentage of the whole educational infrastructure. That's the first thing you need to know. The second is those institutions educate a minuscule sector of our society. And most of them, not all of them, are from the wealthy cohorts of our society. I'm worried about the deplorables. The deplorables have been neglected. The resources available to people who go into pure job training, vocational institutions, the resources available to them are a mere fraction of what we spend on academic research institutions. And that strikes me as completely skewed. There was also an effort on the part of the Obama administration, which a number of people have complained to me about, to shut down the so-called for-profit training colleges. Now, that is due partly to some of the abuses, but it's mainly due, Glenn, to an animosity towards for-profits.
I believe that, I'm not persuaded by defunding, and not just the Ivies because I'm at an Ivy. I'm not persuaded because here's what I'm thinking. I'm the governor of Wisconsin or Minnesota or California or whatever, and I've got a flagship public, North Carolina. I've got Virginia. I've got a flagship public university, Berkeley, UCLA, Madison. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota, University
Virginia.
Yeah. And I've also got a state college system. You know, I've got a multi-tiered educational infrastructure of tertiary educational infrastructure. I might have community colleges. I might have a state college system. I got the university system. Now, you, on your argument, just said that I need to reallocate the emphasis in my structure away from the elite schools in the direction of the average the schools that are catering to the average student. And I'm thinking now about the trade-offs. I mean, what would it mean if the University of California system didn't exist with Berkeley and UCLA and such, and we only had Cal State Fullertons spread around the state? What would be lost if there were no University of Wisconsin-Madison and they were all University of Wisconsin's Kenosha or Milwaukee or whatever, you know?
Well, I'm not just saying Midland University.
That would be a mistake. It'd be a mistake for the long-term economic health of the state. It'd be a mistake for serving all of the people, including the ones who are especially talented, for attracting and retaining the kinds of people that I would want to have in Austin, Texas, as Austin becomes a boom town with high tech coming in from Silicon Valley and so on and so on. So I'm not persuaded by the kind of ultra populist tone of your thing. I'm with you in terms of putting pressure on the elite schools to, you know, to not take for granted the fact that they could just have money coming in over the transom $1 after the other. But I think there's a reason why there might be some stratification in the character of the higher education services that we want to offer to our population. A reason why we might want to have the brightest South Asians coming here to the United States to get their PhDs at Berkeley or Madison or Ann Arbor than going to Britain or France or someplace like that. So
I think you kind of misunderstand what I'm saying. Okay. First of all, I'm not just advocating reallocating resources from the so-called elite universities to more middling universities, although that might be a small part of it. I am really saying we need to just radically rethink how to spend money. And it may be very difficult because a lot of the problems of the average person or people in the bottom half of society may not be amenable to public spending programs. But we need to rethink where we put our resources to pay more attention to the needs and the interests of average people. And it may not be through the university system. I mean, you know, when I was reviewing Richard Reeves' book about upward mobility, I forget the name of it, I started the review by saying, you know, he is obsessed with who gets into the top 20%. Let me tell you something. Only 20% of people can be in the top 20%.
Yeah.
That leaves 80%. What happens to the 80%? I think the elites are so obsessed with their little corner of society, with, you know, upward mobility, with whatever is happening at Berkeley or Harvard or Yale, that they barely pay any attention to what is happening to the rest of people and not giving it serious enough thought. So the guys in Silicon Valley, the big billionaires, you know, the big donors, I would say don't give $100 million to Princeton. Do some hard work. And they're still doing it. All right? They're still doing it. Really put some effort into thinking, is there something else I can do with my money, right, that might be better for society as a whole? And maybe, you know, maybe it's very hard to come up with that sort of thing. Beautifying the environment, giving people spaces to go to that are like the spaces that elite rich people can create for themselves. You know, the real basic quality of life questions that are tearing our society apart. And I'm not saying I have all the answers. Okay. I am not, but I think the lack of ideas about what to do is actually kind of emblematic of that. And once again, I say the academic education, PhDs and the like are for a very tiny slice. Now you mentioned science because that's everybody's heartwarming, favorite cause, but let's do a thought experiment. Suppose that tomorrow all the PhD English departments dropped off the face of the earth. All the sociology departments, you know, sunk into the sea. The vast sort of non-hard scientific establishment that we have created, not just at the very best institutions, but at, you know, fairly middling and mediocre institutions, because the higher ed establishment is vast. It's enormous. It's really a jobs program for half-educated people. That is kind of what it is. If it all disappeared, Glenn, would we be worse off?
Yeah,
because Holland doesn't have that. I am telling you, Germany doesn't have it. It isn't churning out sociology PhDs. It's starting to, which is, you know, kind of scary.
I can't join you in this cynicism. I can't. I mean,
this is bad for us, Glenn. But
I'm thinking. I don't know why legal education and legal scholarship.
I don't exempt myself.
I've got to try to defend my own home turf. I'm going to carve out an exception in the social sciences. No. Come on. There is elevation of the human spirit. And,
oh, heavens to Betsy.
Let me finish. Accomplished by scholarship in the humanities. You can't tell me philosophy is a waste of time. I don't believe you. You can't tell me that literary criticism is a waste of time. Now, you may tell me that an English department has been captured by postmodernists and that the stuff is turning out as garbage, that's a different story. But you can't tell me that the university, without us to study, the systematic and careful study of our literary heritage, is still the full university. Or a mathematics department. I mean, I guess you're going to say science ultimately depends on mathematics or something like that. But there's a lot of mathematics that's never going to touch the ground. It's just pure intellectual, you know, whatever it is. I'm not prepared to scuttle all of this. I want to fight for the turf. And then
how about reducing it to 1/10 the current level or to 1/15 the current level? And here's the other thing. I mean, sure, I am the last person to denigrate pure mathematics. It is the glory of mankind. But, you know, the people who established mathematics, who discovered the basic axioms of mathematics, they didn't have this elaborate university establishment. They didn't need it. They just put their head down and thought about it. And honestly, so that's one point. The second point is, you know, if we got rid of 90% of the math PhD programs, would we really be worse off in any material respect? I think that's a serious question. I am not advocating for getting rid of 100% of them. I am not even advocating for getting rid of 100% of English departments, although I think that wouldn't be a bad thing. And the other point is that for all the good stuff.
Where does the 90% come from? Why not 50% or 20%?
Well, for all the good stuff that's coming out of these places, I think they have, on average, become a liability.
No, I mean, don't we want to go to the professional journals? Don't we want to study the contours of knowledge production in these different areas? I mean, I know the professional journals are going to have articles in them that will raise our eyebrows and we'll say it was a waste of time. But they're also going to have stuff that has engendered, whole subfields and whatever. But I just think you're being too cavalier and dismissive. And it seems like there are a number of different threats to your argument. One of them has to do with the value of vocational post-secondary education that's being slighted here. Another has to do with, I think a revulsion at the elitism and the kind of hidebound, politically left, precious, politically correct tone of mind of some of these people. On the other hand, you want to fight for truth in the university. You want the open space to be able to have the intellectual dark web types heard from on campuses and have questions that interest you and me taught honestly in the classroom. So, we want good students, don't we? We want exceptional students. We want there to be a place where we don't just teach the average mind, where we teach the one in 100 or even one in 1,000 mind.
Glenn, I think your chance of getting people who are old and rigorous.
I'm sorry, it takes so long. The reason that the political correctness battle at the universities matters is because the universities matter. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say they don't matter, let's get rid of them, or 90% of them on the one hand, and say that you're prepared to fall on your sword to fight to make sure that they are open to free inquiry on the other.
Okay, but why do the universities matter now? Because they are propagating this herd of conformist, unindependent, skin-deep minds who are told that they are quote-unquote educated, okay? And you and I know that even in the best places, they are barely educated or in some ways miseducated. So here is an experience that, and this is partly a product of democratization combined in an unholy alliance with political correctness and the politicization of the academy. As I go around the country talking, I occasionally get someone standing up and saying, and it is always a really interesting experience, usually a student, saying, well, you know, what you're saying is racist. That proposition is white supremacy. You know, throwing around these terms that they've been taught to throw around, and I say to them, define white supremacy. I want you to give me a specific definition of what you mean by that. Yeah. Now, interestingly, you know, I've had lengthy exchanges on the web, on websites like Heterodox Academy, where people are dissecting these concepts, coming up with different alternative versions of these concepts, yeah. which is the way it should be, right? Yeah. They cannot give me an answer. They are dumbstruck, to use Jonathan Haidt's term. And I think, God, is this an education?
And I'm here to tell you
that you're allowed. Here's the thing, okay? It's not that people won't say stupid things, because people will say stupid things. They have said stupid things since time immemorial, and they will forever. It's that no one in the university is standing up to them and challenging them to defend their propositions, define their terms, justify their feelings, right? Suggesting to them that their feelings, their reactions, their emotions, their desires for safe spaces, blah, 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 you know, that they might be antithetical to the academic enterprise and that they might simply have no basis or be result from misapprehension or misunderstanding, sort of like what happened with Ronald Sullivan. The brass at Harvard Law School should have sat these students down and said, thank you for telling us how you feel. You're out of line.
Absolutely.
And we're going to teach you why you're out of line. We're going to tell you. That isn't happening, Glenn. It is not happening.
Well, what I want you to know is, and then maybe we can close out and continue this on the next time we talk. Mm-hmm. What I want you to know is that I teach a class on race and inequality to upper-level undergraduates, mostly juniors and seniors at Brown. It's an economics concentration elective. I have 100 students. We have been discussing reparations this week. You could probably predict what my position is, and I don't have time to state it in full, but I'm against this idea of reparations, and I have an elaborate argument about why. It's not about the practicalities, it's about the principle. I don't want a quid pro quo to be the way in which we narrate and conceive of the obligations occasioned by our unjust racial history. I think we've had an unjust racial history, slavery and all the rest. I think it does have implications for how we conduct our public affairs going forward. But the idea that you would convert that into an exchange terrifies and disgusts me. I mean, it really does. It's very wrong. It's deeply wrong, in my opinion. I don't have time really to defend that, and I know it's controversial. All I'm trying to say here right now is my students know what I think because I've given them papers of my own to read along with other things. It's 100 students. They don't all come on any given day, but 70 or 80 of them are in the room, and I'm up there in the front, and I've got the video, and I've got the PowerPoint, and we're talking. And they don't all agree, and they come after with questions, and they come to office hours, and they write papers where they say, no, I'm for reparations or whatever it might be. But they don't get by spouting nostrums, for sure. This is Glenn Lowry. We don't play that in my classroom. And they don't get patted on the head. And you know, I'm doing my job, and I think for some of my students, they really appreciate the fact that there is a debate, even if they don't necessarily agree with what I have to say.
Right. Well, I am not saying that, you know, there is not a single classroom in all of, you know, higher ed where good stuff doesn't happen. Because, I mean, well, you are a singularity, Glenn, but I am certain that there are other places where open discussions are invited. I teach conservative political and legal thought, and I open the class by saying, you know, no one can say I'm offended. You can be offended, but you can't say it. No one can accuse anybody living or dead of being a racist, a sexist. There are rules. There are rules, right? And nothing you say in this class can be squealed about outside of class. And we have some pretty open, raw discussions where people tell me, the students tell me, we can say things in this class we wouldn't even dream of thinking about saying. Yeah. In other classes. That's another theme I get when I talk around the country. I have never had a conservative student say to me, not once, not ever. And I've talked to hundreds of them now. I feel comfortable expressing my opinion. Here's the litmus test. I have never had a student say, I feel comfortable admitting that I voted for Trump. Now that is really, I think, emblematic of what is going on in academia. We have a group of students that is terrified
I agree.
Who admit that they support a sitting president with all his flaws and, you know, shortcomings. Well, I mean, he is the president and he has done some stuff that I think is not so bad, but that's a scary.
You're right about that. I think that's really an important point because my experience is exactly the same.
So I commend you. I congratulate you. And I'm sure your class is great. I wish I could take it. But it sounds like you've created a safe space that's fairly unique. Now, if you talk to Coleman Hughes, my favorite undergraduate, he will tell you that in his philosophy studies at Columbia, the class is varied greatly in the degree of even-handedness, balance that the professor encourages.
Coleman and I are friends, so to speak, despite our years of difference. And I'm friends with his dad, too, who's a he's a terrific individual.
But the students censor themselves.
That's what I was about to comment on. I've never heard a student say they voted for Trump. And in a campus where I've got 5,000 students, it's just mathematically impossible.
Well, I don't know.
I don't believe it. I'm sure some of them voted for Trump, but they will never say so.
Yeah, well, they'll say it when they come into your office and they close the door.
Yeah.
You know, if they know that they can trust you, they'll say it. But they won't say it to their fellow students.
Anyway, Amy is the Robert Mundheim Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a controversial figure, and now you know why. She's also my friend, and perhaps you also know why, because talking to her is always a challenge and an opportunity. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Thank you.
We'll see you again. Bye-bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.